Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work. This is a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it's hosted by me, Kyle Schoenewill, and my friend, Robbie Earle. I don't want to miss this. I want to take another second to say thank you so much for all of you patrons out there who support this podcast financially. We love you guys so much. It truly means the world to us that you would go above and beyond in supporting Friends from Work. So thank you. Robbie, I made a bad mistake. I did something bad. I feel so bad. I feel like I am Matthew Murdoch at confession right now with his priest. It's good and it's bad at the same time.
You should have asked forgiveness for something before you did it.
I'm about to do it. That's so true. Hold on. Let's just roll that back here. Let's restart. Robbie, I'm not asking penance for something I did. I'm asking for forgiveness for something I'm about to do. Oh, wait. Although in this case, I already did it. That doesn't apply. Okay, hold on. How are you, by the way?
I'm great. Man, I'm just happy to be living in Daredevil world here. I feel like we talked about this on our last episode. There's so much going on, and it's also exciting on the what's coming in the MCU front, but I'm also really enjoying this little slice of FFW Plus between the show and the Comics Corner, just getting to hang out with one of my favorite characters.
It's been really fun for me because it's new stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I realized I really enjoy rewatching all the Marvel projects so much, but there is something fun about not knowing what's going to happen.
Right.
And that's what I'm having right now with Daredevil, which leads me to my mistake. I was supposed to just watch episode 5, 6, 7, and 8, pause, so we could talk about it here. I couldn't stop it. I could not stop it. So I ended up watching all of season one. So I already know now what happens, which obviously puts me in a really bad spot, which I apologize for. I'm sorry. Because now I'm trying to talk just about 5 through 8 as if I haven't seen it.
Mm-hmm.
But because I couldn't turn it off, which is a positive, here we are. Here we are.
I mean,
asking for penance.
Look, I was always just hoping that it would find a way to hook you. So I consider this an absolute win.
We're getting so good at it. We're getting so good at it. You're better than me, though.
They just live in my brain in a way that I probably shouldn't be totally comfortable with.
Yeah, it's almost scary how easy that is for you. All right. Well, the only bit of housekeeping I have today is just a reminder to everyone how much we have going on right now. If you really want to follow along with Friends from Work and all we are doing, there are a million avenues for you to do that. So let me just tell you some of them. First off, if you want to stay current with these Daredevil episodes, you should watch the last 5, 9 through 13 of season one soon. We'll be talking about those 5 episodes in a couple of weeks.
And especially soon, by the way, because there's, like we said last time, there's a deadline here, and that Daredevil is being taken off of Netflix at the end of February, and we're not totally sure yet where it's going to go. So TBD on that, right. But maybe follow in Kyle's footsteps and go ahead and binge that so that you don't lose the ability to.
Which you and I will have to have a really interesting discussion on that, because I thought there was no shot of me watching season 2 or 3 before that period at all.
Right.
But now I crushed season 1 and I'm about to go on the road for work where I have a ton of time, and I'm tempted just to go through season 2. So maybe we edit our plan. I don't know, because
right,
I want to get it done before March 1. I don't know. Maybe we just cover season 2 and 3 as one whole episode. Who knows? and space that out before Moon Knight. Anyways, if, like Robbie said, you want to stay current with Daredevil, watch those episodes before they leave Netflix. If you want to stay current with my movie club, you should be watching Arrival. We'll be talking about that in a couple of weeks.
Which I'm very excited for.
And, which is, oh, it's so good. If you want to stay current on our rewatch of the MCU, we are about to have a Saga So Far episode and a rewatch of Far From Home, Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. So be on the lookout on social media at the FFW Podcast for that date. And lastly, Robbie, if you want to stay current with the Comics Corner, what should people be reading?
Yeah, so we're reading Daredevil, The Man Without Fear, which is a miniseries from 1994 by Frank Miller and John Romita Jr. It's only 5 issues. So if you have not started reading that yet, no worries. You can read it in an afternoon. And it goes really, really well with Daredevil season 1. You'll be struck how many scenes are pulled directly from that comic. So it's a really fun companion piece to the Daredevil rewatch or watch.
We understand that's a lot. So if you have to pick your battles, we won't be offended if you choose just one of those outlets. But we only have about 6 weeks left before we're going to dive into full-blown Moon Knight. So this is all stuff we wanted to accomplish before that. So bear with us, and hopefully you enjoy some of the content. Okay, Robbie, let's talk about Daredevil, Season 1, Episodes 5 through 8. Wow, by the way, that's a good theme. Right? I really enjoy it.
There were several moments musically in these episodes specifically that felt very similar to some of the Spider-Man game music. Like not in that he was like using the same melodies, but in tone, like some of the quieter moments.
Yeah, I'm noticing some of that stuff. And he really likes arpeggiated strings. So not to get too nerdy, but he really likes the...
Oh, yeah.
It's like when the action picks up, that's his go-to. Think about the song. I think it's called City of Hope from the Spider-Man video game. You know, where you start swinging.
Oh, yeah.
He does that a lot. And I love it. That's my scene. It's kind of like what Muse steals as well for their music.
Dude, I was just... I went on a long run yesterday and was listening to Black Holes and Revelations. And that album is so good.
They're one of my favorite bands, no doubt.
Man. Also,
okay, anyways, Daredevil.
Running music.
yeah, it is. It is awesome running music. They put out a new single called Won't Stand Down, and it's super metal, like their first record. And I'm not a metal guy, but I love it. It's the best running song. Like, for some reason, their like operatic metal is what I can get into a little bit, but it's just kind of fun to hear them go back to their roots. Anyways.
So this episode we can handle a little bit differently for a couple reasons. One, like you said, this is not one where you are left on a cliffhanger. But also, I think this is just kind of different from that first set. And then I think the first 4 episodes really set the table, gave us a sense of who each character is and kind of what their trajectory is for the show. And this middle chunk, we get one new character introduced, but for the most part, each episode kind of moves one section of that story further along. Right. So I think we can kind of go through each of these episodes, broadly speaking, and kind of do some check-ins on things qualitatively and in terms of story. So the first episode... is called World on Fire. That's episode 5. It was directed by Farron Blackburn and written by Luke Calteau. So this is the one where Fisk blows all of the areas held by the Russians and blames it on Matt, which is how we start to get the Devil of Hell's Kitchen nickname going, and sort of what sets off everything that happens for the rest of this little middle chunk. It's also where we see see how Matt sees the world. And so the world on fire kind of has the dual meaning there.
Quick side note, you chose perfect chunks for this show. It almost felt intentional from the show perspective as well. Hmm. Obviously, four episodes in, the massive, massive cliffhanger of that crazy, brutal scene with Fisk,
right?
But then obviously for this episode as well, like at the end of episode 8, for Fisk to go public, felt like a perfect spot for them to stop. The problem is it's also the perfect cliffhanger that makes me not want to stop. So that's why I kept going. But yeah, anyways, I liked how you divvied this up.
Good. No, I thought so too. I really do think it creates a nice three-act structure here. And this one, I will just say it in general, I enjoyed. It'll be interesting to kind of compare each of these chunks at the end. There were some moments that I felt were a little bit weaker. Like I came out saying those first four episodes were better, I thought, than most individual episodes from Disney Plus series, which by the way, I think I said this, but I want to clarify. I am not necessarily saying that I think Daredevil as a show is better in its entirety. I think my point was, wow, that's a really strong opening to a series. And like what I was saying, I'm not sure that like I think sometimes the Disney Plus shows are a little bit more, like they vary a bit more episode to episode. So I think there are certain episodes of each Disney Plus series that I think are clearly in my mind a notch above almost any one Daredevil episode. I just think there's a bigger difference some in the quality. Like I think the Daredevil series is a little bit more consistent. Anyway, we can have more of a conversation about that next week. But
I can't wait to get into that next time because, like I said, I've seen them all now, and I have some crazy hot takes and just good convo starters about the season as a whole. And because you compared it to Disney Plus last week, obviously that's the parallel we have to draw here. So, anyways, we'll get to that on a bigger scale next time. One of the barometers I like to use, Robbie, is how invested am I in particular scenes and in particular characters as you go along. Like, I've never seen this before. I've only watched it one time. And where does my heart latch onto? And one of the things I seem to be really into is Matt and Claire's relationship, which this episode features a few really key Claire scenes.
Right.
And for some reason, that's a relationship that I buy. Not just that I mean they have to be romantically involved, but their interactions feel very natural and engaging to me. So whenever Claire's around, I'm really into that stuff.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see how you... Do you know anything about season 2 of this show?
I know absolutely nothing. I love it. I love it. I know nothing beyond the finale of season 1.
I love that.
Period.
So I won't say anything at all, but I'm really excited there are things that if people are listening and know what season 2 is, that just make me interested to see how you feel about certain elements that are introduced.
I just triggered them or something.
No, I mean, I think it's a tenuous connection, but
just don't say that.
But yeah, no, you're right. There is a lot of good Matt Claire stuff here. And I think that relationship, it definitely works better for me than Karen and Foggy or Karen and Matt.
And by the way, that's what's so fascinating about this whole thing to me. We are always from the perspective of we've already seen it. We get to see the movies early. So we're always the ones in the know. But it's crazy for me to sit here thinking there are people listening right now going, oh, just wait till he gets to season 3 about that thing he said. Like, think about some of the things you would say about, let's say, Thor. And then someone may say something like, oh, I really love Thor and Jane. And you'll be like, just wait till you get to Ragnarok. It doesn't exist.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you're thinking that. And that's crazy to me. Like, I don't know. Maybe what I just said about Claire is super hot takey because maybe she becomes a villain in season 2 and is a total decanoe. And all of a sudden I'm like, you know, it looks dumb that I said that. But this is my just honest, genuine assessment at the time. You know, I don't know where it's going. Love that.
No, I do love that. I also thought it was really funny here, the storyline with Miss Cardenas, because you last episode had said, you know what I don't want is some like Law and Order style, like every episode they have a new client coming in, which as you've seen now, having watched the whole season, is not how it goes. But I did laugh because the very first episode after last time is like, oh, here's a brand new client coming in and setting up a new storyline. And I was like, oh, I hope that Kyle doesn't get bogged down in that.
I was going to say exactly the opposite today. I was going to tell you that you were correct. And they do get off that feeling storyline. So I was thankful for that. Okay, but yeah, I could see what you're saying with Cardenas. but no, in general, I felt like they did a good job of kind of getting away from that. So
I thought on this episode in particular, and then we can kind of move into the next one from here because this will transition us, about now that you've kind of seen, you've seen Fisk revealed in sort of what he's capable of, but also you kind of got the seeds of the stuff with him and Vanessa and those first four. And now what I thought was really fun here was getting to see what it looks like for him, like how he became the kingpin, like what it is that he brings to the table and the way that he can orchestrate these things, like the way that he winds up making use of the Russians and... like what you said, like the way the last episode ended with, you know, this will start a war, I'm counting on it. I thought that was like an excellent next step in us kind of figuring out who the Fisk guy is. Did that work for you?
Yes. I have three big picture comments here, even if it's not strictly just this episode.
Sure.
One, I wrote from this chunk of episodes, stop making me like Fisk. And I think that's actually genius. Did you catch any of that? Like, they're starting to give him a little bit of heart with Vanessa. Then when you finally see his background, you feel awful for him. Mm-hmm. Like, it. And then, like, I kind of like Wesley. Even though Wesley's a horrible person, I like how loyal he is and the way he's helping Fisk. And so I just started being like, wait, you're kind of making me like Fisk. My second point is, I thought that this episode kicks off a really genius parallel between Matthew and Kingpin in that they both have a dream of cleaning up the city, quote unquote. Uh-huh. Like both Matthew and Fisk want the Russians gone.
Right.
But what's interesting is this episode kind of kicks off an arc of Fisk might actually be doing it better.
Right.
Which is really weird. That goes along with making you like Fisk a little bit in that he's actually cleaning up the Russians in a really tidy way, like he said. And it's awful because you shouldn't be killing people. But at the same time, that's kind of what Matt was tempted to do as well. So it's showing that parallel of, you know, the typical cliche, you know, which is you're not that different than me, which maybe they didn't have to do that. But you know what I'm saying? You're starting to see a good picture of that they aren't that different. And in some ways, Fisk is doing it better.
No, I think that's a really good point. And I actually thought the way that he is basically honest with Vanessa there whenever she calls him on knowing what he really does, and he just says, well, do you remember that news story about the Russians that kidnapped this boy and beat his father in front of him? Like, those are the guys that are getting what's coming to them tonight. And you're like,
right.
Yeah,
that's
true. Fair.
They were awful.
Right.
And on the Kingpin front, when you eventually find out his backstory, and we'll talk about it in a second, it's weird because the show is trying to use that as their leverage of, oh, we gotcha. That's their gotcha moment. If we publish this, they'll find out that he murdered his dad.
Right.
But I'm like, it's not that much of a gotcha moment. He was like 11 years old and his dad was beating and torturing his mom and him.
Right.
It was kind of almost out of self-defense. To me, that's not the big gotcha moment, which is another little layer of me being like, why am I feeling bad for Fisk? Don't make me think that.
Well, and it's funny. Like, I think they do such a good job of crafting this character slowly, and Vincent D'Onofrio's take is so unique. Even the version of the Kingpin you know from the Spider-Man game is very, like, deep voice, booming, a little bit, like, a little bit more clear classic villain.
But dude, hold on. Spoiler alert, in the next episodes, I have to say this now, his fighting style is very similar to the game where he charges you and like lowers his shoulder. He does that a couple times in this and it feels just like Wilson Fisk in the game. That's what you have to avoid as Spider-Man. Uh-huh. Anyways, total side note. Keep going.
That's funny. No, I mean, I think my point here is they make him nuanced in a particular way. Like, I think the character has been, under the right pen, is one of the more interesting characters within the Marvel Comics universe, and Frank Miller is the one that really reinvented him. But even there, he's more kind of straight evil. And there is a certain sadness around he and Vanessa's relationship in the comics, which is pretty different than what we've gotten in the show so far. But I think what the show does well is it roots so much of what he does in this kind of pain. He's always acting out of these wounds. And the way he delivers so many of his lines, but even like whenever he is telling that backstory to Vanessa, he says, and she says what you said, like, oh, well, look, you were just protecting your mother. And he's like, no, I didn't do it for her. I did it for me. And it's just like this interesting peek into.
It's so nuanced. It is so good.
But, and again, that's getting ahead of ourselves. But yeah, I think that I'm with you. The way that we start to see Fisk in action here, I think it does. I think that's the other really interesting thing is even though by the end of this section, things are kind of spinning out for Fisk some, he's also generally through this entire chunk just basically beating Matt at every turn.
Right. Okay, a few other things from this particular episode. Vanessa is such a unique character here because she's weird, right? Like, this is weird. Like, you shouldn't want to stick around with this. Like, I have to wonder if something else is going on, or is she just weirdly sadistically attracted to men like this, which is possible. Mm-hmm. But it just strikes me as a very interesting relationship because all of the first four episodes, I told you, I was more nervous that he's going to kill her than anything. And now we're starting to see that, no, it's actually the opposite. Like, they're starting to settle in. And right. I'm just like, man, what a weird cat to get settled in with. Right. But whatever, I guess, floats your boat. So secondly, in this episode, man, I just don't think the Foggy Karen stuff is improving to me. That really weird scene post the explosion with the touch my face scene, you know what I'm talking about? What the frick is that? She's kind of into Matt, I guess?
I mean, which has, like...
And she's role-playing with Foggy?
It was weird.
I would rank, as the performances go, Karen ahead of Foggy, though. So, to me, Karen is becoming just fine. She's in that average category, like we've done so many times before, right? She's a 6 out of 10 to me. Foggy, though, is still something with the chemistry and the delivery. He's like a 4 out of 10. So when they're together, it's not like a super engaging powerhouse. So those scenes feel wasted emotionally for me. Is that crazy?
No, 100% agree. I actually, this maybe doesn't hold up across the board, but in some ways I feel like they're mirror images where Foggy, I think, actually does have some good writing, but I don't think the delivery is very good. And I think Karen generally has pretty bad writing, but Deborah Ann Woll's delivery helps it out some. But I think that the result is just like none of those scenes. Like every time I come to one of those scenes, I kind of am just waiting to get back to whatever's going on with Matt and Fisk.
I think I 100% agree. Because I brought that up. Foggy has some lines where I'm like, that is okay dialogue. But you're just saying it in such a weird way, like trying to be funny, but like I'm not laughing.
Right.
And my goodness, we're going to get into some of that more Foggy talk in the final episode. anyways, same as the other episodes, contrast that though to Matt kissing Claire.
Right.
And Claire basically backing out of the situation because she's nervous he's becoming Fisk. See, I bought all of that. I really liked that dynamic that she was the one kind of pointing out, you're becoming the same person. So it was another weird thing where whenever it's Matt and Kingpin or Kingpin and Vanessa, I'm all in. Whenever it's Matt and Claire, I'm pretty much all in. And whenever it's Foggy, Karen and Matt, I'm not in, basically. <Right.
laughs> No, I think that's fair. I am much more comfortable with Matt and Foggy's interactions than Foggy and Karen's, and that they're just a little bit less weird. Like, and I think Charlie Cox does a good job of kind of negating, like he responds to the weird delivery of Foggy in such a way that
like shuts it
makes
down almost.
It, yeah. Like it kind of, it makes it work a bit better, I guess, even if it doesn't work. And I, you know, like I like seeing the kind of Nelson Murdoch thing.
Okay. But, so really two quick questions for you.
Yeah.
One, are we supposed to take away that Karen kind of has a crush on Matt? Is that the point of the touch my face? Okay. Okay.
For sure.
Okay. I don't love that, but I get it. The second question is, this is so random. In the Ben Affleck movie, have you seen that?
Yeah.
Jon Favreau is Foggy, right?
Yeah, he is. They apparently, there was a line in No Way Home originally from Happy that was going to, like, I think he was going to say, like,
I'm a bit
foggy on the details or something like that. The conversation with Matt as a shout out. And then I think that they thought it was too gratuitous.
I read that. That's funny. But does it work better there? I've never seen that movie. Does Jon Favreau do a better job of being the sidekick? No. Correct.
Yeah. I mean, I do think it works better there. Charlie Cox, I think, is miles better than Ben Affleck. But I think if you could somehow pair current Charlie Cox with Jon Favreau of 20 years ago, you would have a really nice little team.
Okay. Okay. Because I can see how Jon Favreau could be cast for this role. It'd be a perfect, quippy, really quick-witted. He's always been really good at the sidekick, really quippy, you know, like sidekick to Will Ferrell, like funny,
right,
but heartwarming guy. You absolutely could do that there. So I could see how he was cast for that role. But I also think he'd do a better job than this guy.
I actually think that as folks read some of the Daredevil comics that we'll kind of walk through as he's integrated more into the MCU, fingers crossed. Yeah, I think Jon Favreau is better casting. I mean, I get what they were going for here. But I think he came off just like Foggy here is very kind of heart on his sleeve, overly earnest, very like dorky, which is one iteration of Foggy that we've gotten in the comics. But then I kind of also like the side of him that is a little bit more like exasperated, and like Matt is kind of the optimist in contrast. Like I think I kind of like that more, and what it allows the characters to do. Because here I feel like Foggy is just always being a clown. I think that's the big difference that I'm landing on here.
Yes.
Sorry if I'm talking around that. I think in the comics, Foggy may be the comic relief, but it's more like in contrast to Matt, and that obviously Matt is this like, he's a superhero and he gets all these hot women, and they kind of discuss some of that in the show. But Foggy is never like doing stand-up routines in the office in the comics.
Okay, so that's an interesting comic thing that I didn't know, because the jokes about all the women fall so flat in the show, because I've never seen Charlie Cox act it in a way that he's a womanizer. Like, we've not seen him hooking up with women. We've not seen any of the things they're joking about. And he doesn't even act like that. It's not like he is like slick with other girls when he meets them, or like has some really skanky talk. I don't see any of that, but they keep joking at it in the show. It just doesn't work to me. He'd be like, oh, you're probably on top of another broad. It's like, wait, what?
They overdo it, I think.
But I didn't know that's a comic thing. That makes more sense.
I mean, it is, but again, in the comics, like, you've got room for these things to stretch out. And so it's never like Matt's out on like a one-night stand every night. It's like he has these relationships. Like, I do think one of the things that makes the character interesting in the comics is that he definitely has like a weakness for women, in a way that like Spider-Man doesn't necessarily.
Okay, but they're not showing that here then.
Yeah. Well, we'll see that more in season two.
Okay. Okay. Well,
but
so far I have not seen it then.
Right. Well, no, but anyway,
let's just put it this way. The amount of jokes relative to the amount of times he's a womanizer it's not a good ratio.
Yeah, no, I think that they could have left it at just some of the comments about somehow Matt always knows when women are hot. But I don't think they had to go, because it also gets like Foggy makes these weird comments to Karen that make Matt seem like he's like a sleazebag.
That's what I mean. That's what I'm saying.
Which is not the case. You're like, that's what I'm saying. He's not like, there's no level of him like treating women badly or like being like a sleazy guy. It's just like a weakness of his. And that's part of what I think Stick is getting at in that episode, which we'll talk about in a second. But one comment, though, that I just on that front, because I don't think we'll return to this topic. One thing I thought was funny is, so, you know, Foggy is aware that he has this burner phone that he's talking with this girl on. And he just doesn't find that extremely odd. Like, it's almost not weird for us because we understand that, like, that's the phone that Daredevil has to talk with this person that doesn't know his real identity. But, like, from Foggy's perspective, he's just seeing this girl that he can only communicate with on a burner phone, and Foggy's, like,
oh, cool.
Not extremely weirded out by that.
It's back to that same thing, though. They're trying to play into that, womanizer joke thing. Kind of moving on to episode 6 here, I loved the cliffhanger ending of 5, Daredevil actually being caught by the cops. Uh-huh. And I thought the way they got out of it was pretty cool, because in one scene, you see just how dark and how deep Kingpin's reach goes, how far it extends. Because in that scene, the cop, you know, says, like, leave no survivors or whatever. And then Daredevil's like, wait, what? That's not a cop.
Right.
And I think that's when you start feeling like, oh my gosh, like, this guy is going to be impossible to take down.
That's what starts to make Wilson Fisk the Kingpin and like a formidable villain. And it's like what you and I always talk about. Find ways to make someone a compelling villain and a powerful villain beyond just sheer physical power. And, like, this is, to me, like, I think one of the reasons I'm so excited to see them folded into the MCU is that's kind of what we've asked for in Phase 4, is, like, some more kind of, like, political, on-the-ground, string-pulling power.
100%.
Which is also why I was a little bummed, like we said last time, without repeating ourselves, about how Hawkeye wound up utilizing him in that last episode, because it feels like they kind of missed out on an opportunity to do that, but my hope is that they can circle back and give us more of this kind of Fisk activity. Because I think it's fun to watch, and I think it's fun to watch. It puts Matt in such an interesting position of, like, where do you even go about trying to fight someone that you have no idea who is and isn't under his control, but you almost have to assume that everybody is.
We'll talk about this more, again, as we go along. But I'm starting to soften on that. First of all, I need to rewatch Hawkeye. Secondly, the more they're giving Fisk a little bit of a softer side, and there's a couple times in the later episodes you see him kind of frazzled, the more I buy the iteration of Hawkeye being the same character. So just know in my mind, Robbie, I'm kind of working back the other way. I'm kind of coming back to center on a little bit. So again, we'll get into that later.
Yeah, well, I'm actually really excited, and then we'll have to figure out where our Daredevil rewatch is going, like you said, but I'm excited to be able to rewatch Hawkeye soon with this fresh in my mind, because I've only seen that finale one time all the way through. So I make all these comments on it, but I should, you know, have the disclaimer that that's all from memory of that one watch.
On a non-episode front, have you noticed in general how different the lighting is across the entire show versus what we're used to with Disney Plus? Like, for example, think about Loki and the way everything was so colorful. And I know it's in space, so, like, obviously there's different planets, and we love that. Like, but I think about how much purple was on Lamentis.
Right.
In the tones and stuff. How much brighter it is. Dude, everything here is so darkly shot, not only dark in tone, but dark in lighting. And there's a lot of, like, silhouette shots, and it's grainy, and they have a lot of, like, yellow tones, like streetlight yellow tones.
Uh-huh. Like, there's some green.
Yeah, and, like, the color is just really toned down. There's very little color in general. There's not pops of a bright red somewhere on it, on an outfit or anything. It's very right. like muted and brooding almost. And it's very noticeable anyways, as a side note.
Which I, you know, I was going back and forth between this and Falcon Winter Soldier, which also has some kind of more street level stuff. And that show is obviously less colorful than Loki or WandaVision or even Hawkeye. But I do like I find this the color palette from Daredevil and the way it's shot, although they do the shaky camera thing a little bit too much here in season one. But otherwise, I kind of like how grounded it feels. Like there's something about the like the whenever I swap back and forth, like the Disney Plus shots feel so clean all the time. If that makes sense, like it's what Candace always talks about, like a lot sure. of, well, and you'll get this reference, but a lot of the music that comes out of like certain types of Nashville producers comes out sounding like so clean that almost it's like you want it to have like it's lacking mistakes, a certain kind of character. Yeah. And I feel a little like a tiny bit like that with the way certain Disney Plus shows are shot. Like they don't look bad, but I like some of these episodes. They just feel more grounded.
I'm definitely on the too clean front musically, by the way.
I mean, I am too.
It's a hard thing to accomplish in art because you have to consciously allow yourself to leave mistakes in. And there's times when, as a producer, you just need to be like, that's a mistake that's terrible and doesn't add character. Like, it's just wrong. Like, that's wrong. But there's times right. where it's like, ooh, was that kind of like a perfect mistake to leave in to give it some character? Or like, that vocal should stay untuned. Or in this case, like you're saying, same thing. Like, maybe that camera was too shaky or we didn't catch that just how we wanted. But do you leave it in there so it feels like that? This is, again, big picture. I think there's a happy medium out there that can happen for Marvel Studios. Uh-huh. Like, I think in episodic length, there's a version of a Disney Plus show where it's 10 episodes or 9.
Right.
Not 13, not 6. I think there's a way to make a show feel darker in tone, in lighting, but still have the color and imagination that a Loki right. has. I think there's a way to make a threat feel intense without having to see a guy get decapitated and blood shooting everywhere. So, like, can I get more gore than Falcon Winter Soldier gives me, but can I tone down some of the darkness here? Like there's right. a happy medium out there. And I fully believe that there's going to be a show that comes along and we go, that was it on well, the grounded and, front.
And I really think it could be Moon Knight.
That's what I'm hoping.
Which is why I'm so glad we're watching this now, which was the plan.
Because I couldn't help think about all the discussion we had last week with all these things, Robbie. Is it better than Disney Plus? And my wife and I finished, by the way, she kind of watched it with me. She had her eyes through her hands. But like, there are parts that aren't as good as the Disney right. Plus stuff, in my opinion.
No, I think that's true.
And specifically back to this episode, for me, a lot of it's on the acting front on certain things.
Yeah.
And writing in that way. Anyways, let's get back on track here so we can wrap this up. Because we obviously want to talk about the whole thing.
Well, this as soon as we wrap up this episode, it'll make sense to talk about number 7 as its own thing for sure. But I just wanted to point out some of the high moments of this for me. Like I thought that the Matt Vladimir stuff was, I mean, really intense, but I liked it a lot. I thought it gave us some good context into where Matt's head is. And specifically after that conversation with Claire, where she's like, are you becoming Fisk? And right. then the fact that here we have sort of three elements of that. One, we have Claire seeing these explosions on the news and then hearing that they're blamed on Matt. And you have to wonder if she's like, did he do that? Because she probably thinks he's like on some level capable of something like that to take out right. the Russians. She would understand because she was tortured by the Russians. So that's kind of one element of that tension he's feeling. Then there's the Vladimir stuff where Vladimir is basically like, so what, you're going to stand here and let me die, but you're not going to kill me? So that's where you draw the line. And so he's dealing with it on that level. And then I think my favorite part of the whole episode is the phone conversation that he has with Fisk, where you really kind of see the push and pull of that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I love, like, I always think about, it's such a small moment, but whenever he's like, sounds like you're afraid of what he might tell me. And Fisk, like, without missing a beat, is like, which means he hasn't told you anything yet. And Matt, like, Matt's doesn't like, say anything, but you see him like, ugh.
Yeah.
Because he's just like been, it's like he's being played, like he's outclassed. And again, I just like seeing like that's how Fisk is beating him. Like, yes, you later on you get physical confrontations of the two, but that's not really the battle that these characters fight. It's not about who's going to win in the fist fight. It's more about like this chess game that they're both playing.
And there's a very quick moment where you're almost thinking to yourself, should Matt just back down and let Fisk do it?
Right.
Like, should you just give up here? It might be better, which is the genius of the character.
Yeah.
It's hard not to see the parallels, Robbie, between him and the Joker from The Dark Knight. Correct? Like how, like he's not an elite fighter, but he's pulling so many strings behind the scenes. I just think about like those Batman scenes where even Batman's so defeated. Like, ugh. The final confrontation in that movie when you finally capture the Joker, but then he's like, haha, but wait till you see Harvey Dent. And then Batman just like almost rolls his eyes. Like, are you kidding me? Like, there's another layer to this. That's how I feel a little bit here. When Fisk says
that's
that
a good
kind
comparison.
Of comment.
Yeah, I mean, the only difference being that Fisk has his plans, you know, whereas like
he's
the Joker.
A schemer.
Right. But that's also, I mean, we talked about some of this on our Dark Knight episode, but that's one of the interesting things about that character and Heath Ledger's portrayal is you never know who the Joker actually is in that movie.
I love that you brought that up though. One of my notes here was as much as I love Kingpin and Wilson Fisk, and we've talked about that for 40 minutes already about everything we loved.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little bit left wondering what is his plan, and not in like a fun plot reveal way where I'm like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen. I just wonder, like, is that part of this whole thing underdeveloped? I know he wants a new city, but I'm not really getting like when Leland later is like, you got to stick to the plan. And Gao's like, don't lose focus, stick to the plan. I don't know what it is. What is it?
Yeah,
just to
that's interesting.
Run Hell's Kitchen, I guess. Be like the behind the scenes president. Like, let's say Daredevil's not doing anything to stop it. What does it look like for him? Just make a bunch of money? Like, that's where that's underdeveloped. Yeah. Is that fair?
No, I think that's fair. The sense that I've always gotten is that the big difference between Fisk's vision of the city saved and Matt's vision of the city saved is that Matt wants to protect what's there, whereas Fisk feels like he has to basically raise it to the ground and then build it back up new in his own image. So I think that like some of the stuff, like that's why he's fine just blowing up huge chunks of it, and why he's okay like demolishing, like working with Armin Tully and demolishing some of these areas and trying to force people out, is because it works, one, with the other people that he's meeting with, and you know, you find out the various reasons why they're all in cahoots. But I think from his own perspective, that's, he sees this all as he's going to get rid of what's there currently, and like, you know, Thanos style, an Endgame, like rebuild and you know, start over.
That's fair, but where I think he's one notch lower than the Joker then is I feel like the Dark Knight does such an unbelievable job of painting his motivation, which is just chaos. Like when he burns the money scene. I didn't have that kind of clarity with Kingpin yet, right? Like the money burning thing. Like I need a little bit of that here. Or the Joker giving Harvey Dent the gun and saying, just shoot me then.
Right.
Please.
Well, and to your
it's
point.
It's so genius in that way. And I feel like that's lacking just a teeny bit here.
No, I think that's a good observation. Because to your point, one dot that I don't feel like is fully connected in this season is we get why Fisk has certain motivations from the stuff with his dad. We don't ever really get a clear sense of why he's trying to save the city. Like, where is that coming from? Like, I feel like Matt's is from a, like, I want to protect the innocent. And that just sort of equates to protecting the city.
Exactly, but my point.
Yeah. I guess if I'm trying to dig in deeper, and I don't know if this is fair or not, but I feel like maybe it's the subconscious part of his dad that
wanted
that
notoriety.
Yeah. Well, or like just like his dad was so like wanted to win office and kind of be in a position of power. And so on the one hand, Fisk maybe that's it. I mean, the tension is because he talks about wanting to not be cruel for the sake of being cruel like his dad. But he obviously has enough of his dad in him to where he also wants to be respected and never questioned. And so, yeah, I mean, maybe it's something that he's not even really fully aware of himself that's driving him.
Sure.
And he just has to wrap it in kind of like, I'm the white knight, but it's really just serving his own ego.
Which I love. And from a review standpoint, that's what I'm saying. I think it's very good and he's a genius character. But then I just have to add, like, the one caveat I had was that if you're comparing it to like the best villains of all time, that's where I'm missing some of that just a little bit. But yes, going back to episode 6, I really enjoyed the stuff with Vladimir. I enjoyed the twist kind of Vladimir basically telling him, like trusting him, and then ultimately dying with the SWAT team. But again, so dark. This is one of those moments where it's like, man, this is almost too dark for me. When the bad cops come in and stab the good cop in the throat. That's when I'm like, geez, this is like overwhelming what you can pull off. Which is, again, what I like about it, but also... It is dark. It makes you feel awful as a human.
One thing that I liked about this though is on the other hand, you have Vladimir, who we've seen just be a terrible human being. I mean, they're running a human trafficking ring. So he's like as non-sympathetic as you can be, but he's still like in that very end whenever he does his last stand.
You're so right.
You still get a little bit of like, it's not rooting for him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, you get a little peek at his humanity, and that's what I mean. Like, I just think this show does a good job with some of these. Again, I think it sucks that two of our main characters, I don't think we get this as well with, but some of these other characters that are, like, Fisk adjacent, I do think we get really nuanced portraits of. And
yeah, it gives humanity to awful, awful people.
Right. I like the kind of breadcrumbs here. You know, I'm excited in our last episode to talk about how well the pacing holds up. Because like I've said, I do think 13 episodes is generally too long. But so far, I think it's been a nice, like, you can kind of follow the through line of how Matt's working his way up, what's going on with Fisk, how this is impacting the law firm. But like, even at the end, like that this all ends with him getting Leland Owsley's name. And how that's like the next rung up of Matt trying to make his way to Fisk. I think that works really well for me as kind of a roadmap to follow.
That's a perfect transition into episode 7, which I want to take here.
Yeah.
This is really fun for me because I have no idea if Stick has become like a cult fan favorite. Like TV shows like this have characters like this where I don't know if everyone's like, oh my gosh, that Stick stuff was so ridiculous that it's actually incredible, a la like a Jackie Chan movie or something with the mentor, or if it's the opposite. And that's what I'm going to say. This is by far the worst episode of the whole thing. Am I crazy to say that? You just said the pacing's not been off. I 100% agree until it hits the massive roadblock, which is episode 7. I just didn't, the Stick stuff is so out of the blue and so cheesy to me. Like you could have given me that in 10 minutes and then moved on with the story. The whole like using Stick to get to that moment where Matt has to realize that he can't have relationships the way he's thinking. And Matt gets this moment where it's actually my fault my dad died. That's so cliche to me. Like it didn't have to get to that kind of Matt realization moment. And they use Stick as a vehicle to get there. This was my least favorite episode of the series. And now, did I just say something super blasphemous for Daredevil fans? Or do people agree with me?
So that's a great question. And I'm glad you raised that. Because I did not have as negative of a reaction to it as you did. But I also I think I do agree with everything you're saying on some level.
That's where it first felt side mission-y, side story that I'm like, what are we doing here with Stick?
So this is one of those things where, yeah, it's sort of like Iron Man 2 where you go back and you're like, okay, well, this does not fit. So it's clearly here only to set up some future thing. And that's what's going on here. And just so you know, the reason it doesn't feel like it totally fits is because Daredevil his origin for, you know, the first decade and a half of the character's existence within Marvel Comics, which, mind you, is the portion of the comics that most people feel is the worst. And that's the pre-Frank Miller days, like with Stan Lee and Roy Thomas. There, his origin was basically what we've seen. Like, it boils down to his dad was a boxer. He was sort of a fighter because of that, but then he gets turned blind and uses his senses, and kind of it all coalesces into this superhero that he becomes. And Frank Miller, whenever he came on, added a lot of elements to the mythology, most of which I think enhanced the character, all of which have really stuck around, whether or not you like them or not. But what Frank Miller added is all of this kind of ninja stuff to Daredevil that had never been there before. And he also added this character, Stick, who had been a part of Matt's training, to kind of explain why, okay, this guy is on a level above just like son of a boxer that has super senses. Like, he's also like an elite fighter in this specific way. Like, he's trained in martial arts and all this stuff. And that also opens up the path for Elektra and that stuff that is obviously a massive, massive part of the character's history.
Which I literally don't even know what you're talking about, but don't say anything more beyond that.
I won't, which I'm excited about. But that's why I'm glad you raised that, because I do wonder sometimes, like, even as I've been reading the Comics Corner selection, it feels a little bit like you have two Daredevil origins. There's a comic called Daredevil Yellow that we'll read at some point that I want to space it out, because it's really interesting. They were written within 10 years of each other, but both are kind of summaries of Matt's origin. And Daredevil Yellow was written by Jeff Loeb, who's actually one of the producers on this series. And it basically doesn't deal with any of the martial arts stuff. It just tells like kind of an updated, different take on the origin story that Stan Lee gave us originally of the boxer and all that stuff I talked about. And then you also have Man Without Fear, which is what we're reading, where it leans way more into this like kind of Stick stuff and gives you that side of it. And so I do, my point being, there are, each of these writers have told a story. They're both pretty much canon, and they're both pretty much ways of looking at it. And it's funny how they each focus on different elements and exclude others.
Well, I love this for you then, because I am able to give you the most unbiased opinion possible, because I don't even know anything you just said. I've never read a comic on the Daredevil front or anything like that. So, mm-hmm. And I've never even seen the Ben Affleck movies. So just from a guy who knows nothing about this character, is a fan of the MCU, and I'm watching this series, it felt so out of place. So if you were wondering, like, did that feel out of place? Yes. I think the only time it wouldn't feel out of place is if you had that comic knowledge and you were like, oh, that's cool to see Stick, because I love that Man Without Fear thing, right? But if you don't have that knowledge, it doesn't make sense story-wise. Like, you could chop it out. Like, we already fleshed out his origin story, like you said, with his dad being a boxer. All we would have had to know is that, like, he worked with somebody to increase his skills for 5 minutes. I mean, like, he has this past history. But to try to, like, make him a fatherly figure for a whole episode was super strange and out of the blue. And that's where I say Daredevil season one was 13 episodes. There was like 9 fantastic episodes. And you could have like cut all the rest of the garbage into one episode and made it pretty good, you know, kind of thing, timing wise, in my opinion. So it kind of came out of nowhere to me. I'm not saying like every single moment was wasted. I'm not saying that. And I'm not saying he's a terrible, terrible character or it's terrible acting. It was just like one of these moments where I'm like, what are we doing here? Interesting parallel, Robbie. This is super weird. It seems like a lot of shows have these moments. In Lost, it was this episode called Exposé, where the writers were running out of things to come up with because they didn't know the end date. And so to fill more time, they said, oh, by the way, here's these other two characters, Nikki and Paolo. They've been around the whole time, and here's how you didn't notice them. And it was like so obvious, like, okay, you don't know what you're trying to write. You're trying to buy time while you figure out where this goes. And then, honestly, I loved Ted Lasso, but there's an episode in Ted Lasso with the Coach Beard thing that is like
in season two,
out of the blue, where you could just totally get rid of it. it's a total side story. I think they're trying to be funny. Like Beard maybe has developed like a fan favorite cult following. So we're going to give him a full episode. But it was so bad that Anik and I fast forwarded the ending of it. And then I did research. Sure enough, it's the exact same situation. They had to add an episode later from what they had.
Huh.
So they wrote it in afterwards. And it feels like it's the least appropriate Ted Lasso episode ever. My point is, it seems like this is kind of a trend when you don't know what the end date is going to be, which is something that Kevin Feige and Marvel Studios reinvented with TV shows and movies, where he basically did know where this was going and had a 10-year vision. So he had the luxury of kind of planning that out. So the MCU rarely feels like it wanders to me because I think of his guidance. So anyways.
No, that's a good point. I mean, I think here the issue is something that we've talked about some on the other end with Disney Plus. Like I wish, and I don't know what this would look like, but I wish that whether it's Disney or Marvel, that these conversations would be less, okay, this is the amount of episodes that you have, now kind of fit a story within that. Even though I think that's fair, you know, and I think a good writer should be able to do that, I wish that it were instead, okay, here's the show that we're doing. Figure out the amount
of space
you need.
How many episodes do we need to make it work?
Yeah. Yeah. Because this was just the age, if you remember, when, like, I think this came out the same year as, like, House of Cards season 2, maybe. Like, this was early Netflix, like, right before Stranger Things. And Stranger Things was the first one that did, I think, 8 episodes and kind of broke the trend. But prior to that, every Netflix series was 13 episodes, which is so long for, like, prestige television like this. Like, I know seasons like West Wing used to be, like, 20-something episodes. But currently, it's just, you have 13 hour-long episodes to tell one season story that's also kind of like the origin story for these characters. You're almost guaranteeing that you will have at least a few meandering things like this.
That is such a freaking good point. Like, imagine if they had said, here's the story we want to tell for Loki. Here's the beginning, here's the end of it, and here's how we're going to get there. How many episodes do you need? I love that idea. Maybe they would have come back with, hey, let's do 4 1-hour episodes. Or maybe they'd come back with 10. But that's an interesting concept. Versus, hey, we're going to do another 6-episode season next year before you even know where it's going.
Right. Well, and I think it's so interesting that WandaVision is the one that feels...
That's the one
like
that
it's
works.
It's the exact right amount of episodes.
It's
and
perfect.
It's a random number. It's 9.
Yeah. And that's fascinating too, Robbie, because with the sitcoms, right, like they couldn't have gone back much further because, A, there wasn't a whole lot of television if you go back further. But that's maybe an example of what we're saying. Maybe they said, hey, we want to do a 50s, a 60s, a 70s, an 80s, a 90s, and a 2000s, and then we need to have a finale that wraps it, and we need to have a backstory with her. And like maybe that's how they filled it out.
Right.
And then said, that's how it's 9. You know what I mean? Versus saying, you have to make 9 WandaVision episodes. And then they go, okay, how do we do that? I don't know.
Right.
But I see what you're saying. Because it fits perfectly. And I wouldn't have wanted a 10th one for that show. And I don't think I could have afforded 8.
Yeah.
Because like you needed that 4th episode of seeing Tiana Paris get thrown out and you go back to the real world. Like you needed to see that. And you need episode 8. And you need the finale. Like you need her getting the character development of going back through her memories. So the only thing you could have done then would have been to cut out one of the sitcoms, which I don't think ever drag and fit perfectly. So
right.
If they had done one more sitcom, you would have been like, okay, like it's hard for me to believe that Wanda can still just keep doing this with everyone kind of figuring it out. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, and the pacing in WandaVision of how they kind of make the sitcoms increasingly interrupted, but like and add the kind of eeriness of like the first time that she tries to run the credits and he stops. Like, I'm not trying to get on a WandaVision tangent, but my point is, like, it does feel so intentional. Like, it's really hard for me to imagine that there was a mandate from Disney to do 9 episodes and then they just wound up getting there perfectly. Like, it has to have been what you're saying, where it's like, this is what we want to do. These are the amount of episodes, and they wound up there, whether they were initially given 7 or 8 and expanded or what. And it's just interesting to me that the rest of the series are the ones that I think, to the degree there are pacing issues, which I'm not saying they all have pacing issues, but I think that, no, I've not really seen anyone make that complaint about WandaVision, and I think that that's maybe why.
But anyways, to get us back on track and wrap up Daredevil.
Right.
We move from that and we go back to the main story with a Fisk flashback episode. Very much like Lost, in the style of like, oh, you're wondering more about Fisk? Here, let me tell you his backstory in an actual dedicated episode. That's what Lost did every time. What were your feelings on this, his origin, basically?
I thought it was excellent.
So did I.
We spent those early episodes getting the backstory on Matt, which makes him such a such a sympathetic character. And then you find out that, you know, as bad as Matt had it, Fisk had it worse. And I do think it adds a level of, again, it adds some humanity to this, you know, on his surface, terrible person.
They also include an incredible Easter egg with the wall that he was forced to stare at, and that's why he's drawn to the painting. It's why it makes him feel alone. It's why he ultimately got attracted and connected with Vanessa in the first place, which I thought was an interesting Easter egg. Man, his backstory does do a good job of making you feel for him. It's oppressively dark. Like,
yeah.
Did you feel that watching that? Am I crazy? Am I just some like goody two shoes that doesn't handle this? I mean, it's like very, very dark. Not just in the fact that he kills him with a hammer, but more in the fact that like he's beating his mom, and then the kid who's having to witness this in his sheer moment of terror is yelling the keep kicking him thing, which is super dark. That's like been implanted by his parents. Maybe it's because I'm a dad that I'm more sensitive to this. And then in the craziest twist of all, his mom doesn't miss a beat and saws up his body as if his mom now knows how to like remove a body without it being.
Right.
Like that's a crazy level of darkness that his mom had like basically been plotting this, if you will, as well.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's just, you feel for him, but it's a tough watch. Am I crazy?
No. I think that's very fair. Yeah, everything is it's so intense on the violence in this show. And I remember there were a lot of tweets about this, like back in 2015 or even in season two as well, where people would laugh because it's like there are
parts of this that are like Saw level, bro.
Right. But the funny thing is not that I'm saying that they needed more of this, but it's just such a funny line to draw. You'll notice, like, as compared to like the average HBO show, I would argue this is more violent. But what's funny is like there's zero nudity and there's zero language. So it's like they're like, we're going to be sure, you know, to stay firmly on like the PG-13 side of this stuff. But whenever it comes to violence, we are just going like,
we're dialing it up to the most extreme
dialing to 11.
Possible. Yeah.
And I just wonder what the rationale, like I'm not being like there should be more nudity in language. I just think it's funny where they decided to draw that line.
I 100% agree. And that's where I do say, like, I do think there's a happy medium there. I think there's a way to make a show super, super dark that my wife can still watch.
Right.
And even if there is a little bit of language or nudity in it, there's probably a way to do it that's more appropriate than some of this.
Right.
And I've noticed, like, it's not so much that guys get beat up or shot and, like, you see blood. That's not the gore part. It's that they're intentionally lingering the camera for like five strikes longer than a typical show would do. Uh-huh. So like he hits his dad in the back of the head with a hammer. That's dark, but I've seen that before. But then they show him yelling, stop kicking him, and hitting him in the back of the head with a hammer like 10 more times to where he's getting covered in blood.
Right.
And then include the line of get the saw. I mean, that's like you went from a violent show to holy crap, like turn the camera away. Like we get it. He's traumatized.
And the sound editing there is so intense.
Yeah, and they crank the volume. You know how we talk about how, like, Loki's neck crack is turned up, the volume?
Right.
This is, like, every punch is turned up. That's, like, the loudest thing. It's louder than the dialogue.
I know. Aside from the backstory stuff here, I also really like the real-time Fisk moments, like him flipping the table when he gets so frustrated. Because it's like, that's what I think D'Onofrio does so well, is the way he delivers the average Fisk line. It feels like there's all of this pent-up rage that he's trying to contain. And then in these certain moments, it spills out, and it is kind of terrifying. And he's even like yelling at Wesley and demanding that Vanessa get out. And I think that's why her coming in and having that kind of softening is so well done, in my opinion, is you kind of see why he's going to start to value her presence so much.
To add to that, too, I think it's that layer of emotion. They're making him a very emotional villain.
Right.
That is kind of fresh and unique. Not that all villains aren't emotional, but, you know, I was comparing it to the Joker. Mm-hmm. Like, the Joker is basically devoid of emotion, right? Even when he's getting beat up, he's laughing about it. He's kind of dead inside, right? So there's a difference there. And then I think the other option you can take with typical villains is very, 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 very smart, confident, and cunning, to where they don't allow themselves to get super, super pissed off. I kind of think about, like, just off the top of my head, I think a little bit about like Killian Aldridge, right? Like how he's always under control and cool and smooth. Same with kind of like Alexander Pierce or Rami in the latest Bond. Rami Malek, whatever. Like how they're always kind of under control.
Right.
But I like that here, they're really playing off that actually Kingpin is super emotional. Like he doesn't actually kill the guy until they ruin his date with Vanessa. Then because he was embarrassed, it's not just I'm going to kill him. It's I'm going to snap his head off with a car door. And then I can't really bring this up, obviously, because of the future. but like the way he handles Ben is all emotional. It's all just emotion. And the thing here that doesn't really, it's not the conversation with Gao that really throws him off. It's when someone triggers something super emotional in him that he flips the table. And I like that. Right. That feels a little different to me.
No, I agree. It's like, again, it's just a more complicated, like I like that there are the two kind of archetypes, like what you laid out, and that they make a point to have one foot on in either world with him.
Maybe this is blasphemous, but it feels a little Kylo Ren-ish almost.
Oh yeah. Like, that's a good comparison. Like Last Jedi era.
Well, yeah. Cause Anik and I joked about that when there's a scene in Star Wars when he's so pissed, he's like slashing the elevator and the stormtroopers walk away. And it's kind of funny. They're like, oh, they're not going over there, because he's like in a rage mode. And there's a moment like that here a couple times where he flips the table and it's like, oh, let's back out. Like, don't need to be in here.
Just back it up.
Just back it up.
So a couple more things to talk about here. And then I had one kind of big picture thing I wanted to talk about, and we can wrap. Two things just quickly about this episode that we haven't covered. One, I also thought that the stuff in the hospital with Blake and his partner, one, is again very dark. The, like, you know, we've been friends for years, and Fisk asking how much is each of those years worth to you in round figures, is so dark. But
also
then,
amazing. Yes.
Right. But then talking about like the narrative moving along with Matt and Fisk, and the push and pull that I just think is so great, is it's like you can't figure out who has the upper hand, because Matt gets in and manages to get the information out of the detective before he dies, which is a win, and which Fisk hates. But then on the other hand, Fisk is able to then use that to frame him for the murder of the detective, which then like further vilifies Matt. So it's this like, it's so, the kind of constant escalation, I think, is so well done in that way.
The chess match. Yeah.
Right.
Can I say one other tiny caveat that I haven't said either?
Yeah.
I love Ben Ulrich, the reporter. I haven't brought him up, but I think, A, he's acted fantastically well.
Uh-huh.
I like his storyline of trying to get back to his true reporter roots. Like, why did he become a reporter?
Right.
And I like the idea that while Matt is out there being daredevil, punching information out of people, Foggy, Karen, and Ben are trying to go the legal route with pinning Fisk. And I think the parallel stories there works well. A large part of that is because of Ben. I think Ben's a really good character. I mean, am I crazy on that? Is that a hot take?
No. I was actually, out of curiosity, looking back at how certain performances and certain elements of the show were received. And one of the things that was generally agreed on was how great Ben's character is and how great the performance is there. And he is a crucial part of the Daredevil mythos as well in the comics. But man, I really like this iteration of Ben. I really like the moment we don't get that many of them, but the rare moments that we have between him and Matt, I think are excellent. And like the questions he's asking of Matt, where it's like, oh, okay, so you had someone to corroborate that, you know, whenever the dying detective told you this information.
Right.
So that's something, so you think I can just print that, you know, this information that you beat out of people?
Right. It points out the legality issues, but also the just practical issues with it all. And the inevitability of how deep Kingpin's reach goes, you know?
Well, and then that final scene is one of my favorites in the whole show. Of one, I just love the writing of that you see, you hear the voiceover of the article, and then you see it coming across the screen, and that at the same time as Fisk making his announcement and the way the language all lines up. I just think that's
right.
A really well executed scene.
Right, and he was going to write the story, which, by the way, you feel this terror the whole time because you've seen what Kingpin is capable of and because you've seen how many strings he pulls. The whole time you're thinking to yourself, Matt, if you encourage Ben to write the story, he's going to die. They're going to kill him. And then Ben kind of putting that together, realizing if I write this, this probably is at least at minimum the end of my career is what he's thinking, at minimum. But at worst, it might be my death. And still choosing to write that parallel with, yes, Kingpin coming out and basically saying the same thing to the public.
Which is so genius. And again, I think it makes Vanessa such a strong character because that's coming purely from her. And the way that she like picks out his outfit and helps frame the whole thing, I just think it's like, it adds a dimension to her where she's not just like, oh, the woman that makes him feel safe or comfortable that he's in love with, but she really is adding this whole dynamic and partnership element to his enterprise.
Well, and don't say anything to this, okay? But that's one of the storylines I'm genuinely interested to follow in season two is there more to Vanessa or is she just that? And I'm just kind of curious. So don't say that yet, but I won't speak to that.
I'm so excited for to get your take on season two for a variety of reasons. But the big picture thing I wanted to talk about, and this will not take long, will maybe come up again as we keep marching through this show. But I just thought it was really interesting as I was looking back at the creative teams that we've got on here. We have a different director almost every episode.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that.
Which is interesting, but we do have, there are some repeats, but it's not like Disney Plus where there's one director over the whole show, but the writers cycle a bit more. And I thought it was funny because we listed some of the creators on this last time. And I talked about how much I loved those first four episodes. The first two are from Drew Goddard, who we talked about as a collaborator of Joss Whedon. And it kind of makes sense because I like his work and I really liked those first two episodes, especially. And the last two were from, respectively, Marco Ramirez and Joe Pulaski, the last two being episode 3 and 4, which I also liked a lot. And it's just interesting kind of as we're always trying to figure out who as a writer we really respond to. Of these four, the first episode, episode 5 that we covered today is from Luke Calto, who I'm not familiar with, but it's funny how I remember some of those moments in that episode, like what you're talking about with the Karen Foggy, like feeling the face moment, like as much as there are some good moments, I also remember coming off of episodes 1 through 4 and thinking how excellent they all were. This was the first one where I was kind of like, some of this writing isn't quite hitting even for the Matt Clare stuff. There were like a couple moments where I was like, this is a little strained. He's going to end up writing an episode later on in the season. And I'm kind of curious to come back and think like maybe we just respond or I don't respond as well to him as a writer. Because then episode 6 was written again by Joe Pekaski and Marco Ramirez together, who had written episodes 3 and 4. And that one I liked a lot, like that we talked about that with him and Vladimir. But this is the thing that I'm kind of curious to keep an eye out for. Episode 7, which, you know, you said was your least favorite, was written by Douglas Petrie, who winds up being one of the showrunners for the Defenders series, which is also a notable step down in quality from this show. So I wonder if he's just a creative voice that we're not going to love. Because I think he is the one that's sort of in charge of bringing in a lot of the, like, ninja side of this. But episode 8 was written by Stephen S. DeKnight, who is the showrunner, and who I think has also, like, he's behind some of the later episodes that I like, and he seems to kind of be brought in at some of the big moments plot-wise. In the back half of the season. So that may be boring to people, but I just always think it's interesting to try to figure out the tone that each of these writers is bringing, especially when you have a larger team, and to kind of trace that with how we felt each episode land. Because I do think that it's significant who's actually doing the writing there.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I honestly didn't know it was that many different writers at all. So I wasn't looking for that. It would be interesting to go back and watch and see if I could pinpoint that. Like, specifically this episode. Also, I'm binging it, so you're kind of just blazing through them.
Right.
But, like, specifically, you know what? That episode felt, like, a little weak in the dialogue category. Or, like, that episode felt pretty great plot-wise. I wonder if they brought in the big names or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know. I wasn't conscious of that. But that is fascinating. And it's also just fascinating to me that you would use that many different writers. So I wonder what the thought process is behind that. Like, how is that an advantage? But maybe it is. Maybe the director and showrunner can really give their main take, and they're just looking for people to fill in the dialogue parts more. I don't know. But, that'd be interesting to track.
I'm really curious to track the next one, too, because the first episode is everyone that writes these last five that we'll talk about they're returning, like it's a cycle back. So it'll be interesting to kind of compare. But the next episode, episode 9 that we'll open next podcast with, was written by Christos Gage, who I was talking about in that first episode being the head writer for the Spider-Man video game. So I'm curious to see how you felt about that episode. And again, I think it's just fun to trace some of these guys' particular styles.
Well, and for next time, when we talk about episodes 9 through 13, like we said, watch those if you want to stay current with us. I have very specific notes about specific episodes, so that will be interesting. I'll ask you, like, who wrote these two, because I have takes about these episodes in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe we'll be like, oh, that was also the guy who wrote 7. I don't like this one, or whatever. Maybe, right. I don't know. So, yeah, let's track that. But, dude, this was really fun, and I am really, really jazzed to actually finish it up because, like I said, spoiler alert, I watched it, and I have some things I want to talk about. So
I can't wait. I've got to get on it. I've got 5 hours of Daredevil to catch up on.
Right, which there's worse things in the world.
True.
Thank you guys so much. As we said at the beginning, we are so appreciative of you guys being patrons and helping sponsor Friends From Work. We couldn't do what we're doing without you guys, and so thank you so much. So we'll see you next week, probably talking Comics Corner, Daredevil style. And then we'll see you the following week with Daredevil Season 1, Episode 9 through 13. So we'll catch you there on Friends From Work Plus.
Of fun await this winter in Indiana. Feel the rush of the Midwest's only refrigerated toboggan run. Ski down snow-covered slopes and marvel at frozen waterfalls on a winter hike. When it's time to unwind from outdoor fun to indoor escapes, your perfect winter getaway starts in Indiana. Plan your trip today at inindiana.com/winter.